Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. The House impeachment process picks up steam. Next week, the formal inquiry will hold hearings for the first time in public. House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff announced the move on Wednesday.
Those open hearings will be an opportunity for the American people to evaluate the witnesses for themselves, to make their own determinations about the credibility of the witnesses, but also to learn firsthand about the facts of the president's misconduct.
Meanwhile, this week's election results offer a lot of promise for Democrats looking ahead to races in 2020. Republicans hold on to the Mississippi governor's mansion, but Democrats sweep both houses of the Virginia legislature. And a Democrat claims victory in the Kentucky governor's race with a razor-thin margin. Apparent winner Andy Beshear told a crowd of supporters on Tuesday that his victory sends a clear message.
It's a message that says our elections don't have to be about right versus left. They are still about right versus wrong.
The Republican incumbent says not so fast and claims, offering no evidence, there may have been voting fraud. And former Attorney General Jeff Sessions runs for U.S. Senate again. He announced his bid for his former Alabama seat last night to Fox News' Tucker Carlson.
I have some convictions that I think need to be pushed. We need to get some Republicans moving. They haven't been pushing hard enough to advance the Trump agenda. And so that's what I look forward to doing. And if I think I can contribute to that.
Join us. How have the latest revelations affected your thinking about impeachment or about the president? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on the Twitters and the Facebooks at On Point Radio. With us from Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, Karen Tumulty. She's national political columnist for The Washington Post. Karen, great to have you back.
Great to be here.
Also with us from Washington is Jackie Kucinich. She's Washington bureau chief for The Daily Beast. Jackie, great to have you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty, once more joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Jackie, and Karen.
So let's talk, I guess, first. Jackie, you've been covering this mishigas in the Capitol Hill. Let's talk about the impeachment hearings. We're going to talk a bit about what we've learned this past week. But first, let's talk about the prospect of public hearings, long clamored for from, in some ways, both the right and the left. What's on tap, and what does that signal to you?
Yeah, so in some ways, Republicans are getting exactly what they wanted, bringing this into the light. And we've been seeing that also with the release of the transcripts of the various officials that have already testified to the investigators over the past few weeks. Don't expect them to say thank you or anything, though. That doesn't happen in impeachment land.
Gratitude, not on the agenda.
Not a thing. But, you know, next week we will hear from Ambassador Taylor, who, of course, was the envoy in Ukraine. And he, when he testified, his testimony that was released this week and when he testified to members of Congress, they were really shocked by the vivid way that he described this scheme that Sondland and Volker and Giuliani had tried to concoct beyond a dual track to diplomacy to try to get the Ukrainian president to announce an investigation into Ukraine.
So Jackie, let me just stop you there so I can give listeners just a taste of what that sounded like. That was behind closed doors. That was late last month that Ambassador Bill Taylor gave his testimony to the House Intelligence Committee. The transcript released, as you say, just 2 days ago. Representative Sean Patrick Maloney of New York, he's a Democrat on that committee, spoke Wednesday on MSNBC about it.
Ambassador Taylor chose specific words. He said this was about political gain. This was about advantage in a political campaign. So my questions were designed to get at exactly what he meant. He didn't say investigations. He didn't say just Burisma. He made crystal clear that he knew that there was a quid pro quo being demanded. He puts it together very clearly, a quid pro quo that would benefit the president personally, politically, and it's wrong.
So, Jackie, that gets at a little bit of what you're trying to convey there, that this is significant testimony, you think.
Right. And they believe that, he was such a good witness, and his testimony was so convincing that it may move the needle, perhaps, with the public, because a lot of this is a public campaign and to get the American people on board with a potential impeachment of the president. We will also hear from Deputy Assistant Secretary of State George Kent on Wednesday. And then finally on Friday, the former ambassador to Ukraine, Masha Yovanovitch, who several of these witnesses have testified, was pushed out in part by Giuliani and others, will testify on Friday. So it's going to be a very full week.
Jack Beatty, the most recent transcripts came out just yesterday about George Kent. He's an assistant secretary of state. Presumably, you think of someone as probably pretty, you know, loyal to the secretary of state, Mike Pompeo, and the administration. You know, what struck you about what he had to say?
Well, he decried in harsh terms the campaign of what he called it, campaign of slander and lies, mounted by Rudy Giuliani to discredit the ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. And he went on to say that as a career diplomat who has seen how political, how in abroad banana republic practices of using the power of government to prosecute your political enemies, he was incredulous to find himself in the middle of something like that in Ukraine. That, in other words, the president was trying to use the power of the Ukrainian government in this case to prosecute his political enemy, Joe Biden. And he did give some fodder, and we'll hear more about it, to Republicans when he mentioned that when he was in the Obama administration, because he's been a diplomat for a long time, he warned the State Department about the Hunter Biden's role in Burisma. He raised the question, and I raised my concerns that I'd heard that Hunter Biden was on the board of a company owned by somebody the U.S. government had spent money trying to get tens of millions of dollars back. And that could create the perception of conflict of interest. He then says, the message that I recall hearing back was that the vice president's son, Beau, was dying of cancer and that there was no further bandwidth to deal with family-related issues at that time. So the Republicans are seizing on that.
So, Jack, from what I'm hearing from you, in some ways it's as though it's a reminder that citizenship is in some ways an advanced level challenge, in that we've got to keep two things in our head. There may have been legitimate questions to ask about the Bidens, and yet what this career diplomat, what this very senior State Department official was testifying to, at least in the private testimony that we've seen the transcripts of now, was that what he saw from Rudy Giuliani, the president's advisor, emissary, and lawyer, was completely inappropriate. And it was completely circumventing what the way in which diplomacy is supposed to work and how foreign relations are supposed to work.
That's right. It was a sort of ad hoc, which is a Latin way of saying chaotic and possibly shameful effort to run American policy on his own. With what connection with the president, we don't know. It's interesting. Washington Post today says the new Republican defense is we're going to throw Giuliani, Sondland, and Mulvaney under the bus and say they did this all on their own. President had nothing to do with it.
So, Jack, we'll get back to the question of the Republican strategy maybe after this first break. But Karen Tumulty, I want to bring you in to talk a little bit about a name that Jack just mentioned, Gordon Sondland. He's the ambassador to the European Union, someone whose words don't always make world headlines, right? And yet we've been paying very closely attention to him and parsing what he's had to say exceptionally closely because of the revision to his testimony. What did we learn from the ambassador this week about what he had said in previous weeks?
Well, and the ambassador's loyalty to Donald Trump is not in question here. He was a major campaign contributor. Why is the EU ambassador even involved in the Ukraine? But he suddenly decided this week, before the transcript of his testimony becomes public, to change it on a very, very key point where he said, oh, yes, I suddenly remembered. I did tell a top aide to the Ukrainian president that, in fact, there was a quid pro quo, that there would be no military aid without opening this investigation into the Bidens, which is a pretty important change. And it suggests that, you know, the most likely explanation for this is he suddenly realized that he might be headed for a perjury charge.
I mean, there have been a parade, Karen, of other witnesses coming forward and saying, by the way, we saw this as a pretty explicit quid pro quo.
Exactly. And it's the, you know, great irony here was, you know, the president keeps saying, read the transcript, which he's referring to the not it's not a transcript, but the notes from his own phone call with the Ukrainian president, which I think a fair reading suggests that, yes, there was a quid pro quo in there. But now, you know, every time you hear the phrase read the transcript, you realize it's plural, read the transcripts, because there is a very, very consistent picture emerging here.
Jackie Kucinich, I want to briefly, before our break, we don't have a ton of time, but I want to talk about the question of the whistleblower. There's been a push among Republicans to consider naming him. At a rally in Lexington, Kentucky, with President Trump on Monday, Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky pressed the media hard to reveal the identity of this whistleblower.
We also now know the name of the whistleblower. The whistleblower needs to come before Congress as a material witness because he worked for Joe Biden at the same time Hunter Biden was getting money from corrupt oligarchs. I say tonight to the media, do your job and print his name.
Now, Jackie Kucinich, we got about 40 seconds left. You know, the president's supporters are saying somebody accused has the right to face his accusers. On the other hand, the point of whistleblower laws are to protect the identity of those who bring forth problems that were set out by the whistleblower and then reinforced by some of these witnesses.
Right. And to keep them safe from intimidation, Rand Paul in particular, it's interesting because he's someone who's advocated for whistleblower protections in the past. And it's not just him. If you read these transcripts, you see Republicans have a concerted effort to name him during those as well.
And how common or how appropriate is that?
It's inappropriate. I think any experts in security and whistleblower protections would say that this isn't okay and have said.
We're talking about the week's top news. You can join our conversation. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're taking a deep dive into the week that was. You can join our conversation. Later on, we'll be talking about this week's election results. For the moment, we want to hear your thoughts on the impeachment inquiry. It's led by Democrats and assailed by Trump's Republican allies. Follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and On Point Radio. We're fortunate enough to be joined this week by Karen Tumulty. She's national political columnist for The Washington Post. Jackie Kucinich, she's Washington bureau chief for The Daily Beast, and our own news analyst here at On Point, Jack Beatty. A little bit of news earlier this morning, Mick Mulvaney, he's the president's acting chief of staff, that acting still part of his title, was the leader of the Office of Management and Budget for the federal government. He skipped his invitation this morning to attend the impeachment inquiry and to give testimony as well. He's one of a series of senior figures. I believe Rick Perry, the Secretary of Energy. Jackie, has the Secretary of State been asked yet to come give testimony? I can't remember.
I believe he has, I don't think he's been subpoenaed or anything, but I would have to check that. Let me do that. it all blends together after,
you know, it kind of
thousands of pages of transcripts fly by your face.
And there is, Jackie, there is this question of the strategy of the Democrats, whereas, you know, do they want to compel with subpoenas and do they want that to be possibly thrown into the courts and have rulings against them. Right now, I think John Bolton, the former national security advisor, and another figure represented by the same lawyer have put a query in front of a federal judge basically saying, the administration is telling me I can't under executive privilege and the Congress is saying I must. Which way do I go on this?
Now, something did happen with that case overnight or yesterday, and I would have to check it. But to your point, they have been fighting this in the past, but now that we're moving quickly and we're moving into these more public forums, the focus seems to be shifting there and rather than, you know, fighting some of these other officials. But again, I would have to check and see what the movement on the lawsuits are.
So let's talk a little bit, Jack Beatty, about the Republican response to all this. There seems to be shifting variety of defenses. There's the question of just saying, who the heck would do this? Standing alongside President Trump at a rally in Monroe, Louisiana on Wednesday night, Republican Senator John Kennedy tore into U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi is trying to impeach him. I don't mean any disrespect, but it must suck to be that dumb.
So Jack Beatty, in that instance, just dismissing the prospect. We've heard others seemingly go from a no quid pro quo to a yeah, so. And then we've been hearing a little bit from Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, often a defender of the president. He gave a very specific defense of the administration's actions toward Ukraine in talking with reporters earlier this week. Graham said it wasn't pretty.
I've read the transcript for myself. I made up my own mind. Volker, the special envoy, said there was no quid pro quo. Sunderland has changed his testimony to say he presumes there was. What I can tell you about the Trump policy toward the Ukraine, it was incoherent. It depends on who you talk to. They seem to be incapable of forming a quid pro quo. So, no, I find the whole process to be a sham, and I'm not going to legitimize it.
Jack Beatty, what do you see in terms of the ways in which Republicans are coalescing around arguments that can try to slow down, beat down, or fight against the damaging revelations that are surfacing in these impeachment hearings?
Well, they're really having to reach for it because the facts are against them, as this tattoo of revelations, one deposition after another, one senior official after another, confirms what the whistleblower said and confirms the implication, do us a favor, though, of a quid pro quo in the transcript. So how are the Republicans reacting to this? The president, 30-some tweets, just the last few, well, I guess the last week, on the whistleblower. Where is the whistleblower, he says. The whistleblower's attorney says he's right here. He's where he's always been. He hasn't gone away. And the whistleblower's appearance, of course, would be superfluous, redundant. The revelations have gone beyond him, and his claims about the transcript, or the document such as it is, have been borne out by said document. The president has a third tweet vein where he speaks of it. He says, something happened, but it wasn't, quote, an impeachable event. And I think we're going to hear more of that questioning, of that line. It, you know, maybe I was acting a little bit like a real estate mogul and so on. Of course, he wouldn't even go that far. But it's not an impeachable event. Of course, the Democrats reply by saying, well, the Constitution speaks of treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. Extortion, which is really what a quid pro quo amounts to, looks like bribery of a foreign official. So the president's going to have trouble with not an impeachable event. And if he looks for help to the House Republicans, the transcripts don't show them as great sleuths. These are not this is not Perry Mason, as somebody said. They have talked about, what are their questions dealt with? Conspiracy theories. The Bidens, George Soros, the Clinton Foundation, Hillary Clinton, the deep state, all of that. And then questions like this to Ambassador Yovanovitch. Ambassador Yovanovitch, do you believe that it's appropriate for your opening statement to be provided to the Washington Post? That is a paradigm of the pathetic. If that's the kind of thing they're doing, it may do them good on Fox next week. But if that's the caliber of their questioning, it doesn't seem like it's going to be very persuasive to members of the public who are persuadable.
Karen Tumulty, we just heard their clips from two Republicans in the Senate. Are you seeing different defenses from those in the House who are trying to create what, you know, obstacles they can find towards the president's impeachment in the House before it even goes over to the Senate? Is the party unified, or are there different tactics from different clusters, I guess is what I'm asking?
Well, I agree with Jack. One of the more disturbing things is seeing the House Republicans sort of throwing in all these bizarre, far-fetched conspiracy theories. It's pretty clear now where things are headed in the House. And by the way, the direction of public opinion on impeachment is also pretty clear. Since July, we now have a plurality of Americans saying in many polls that they would not only like to see the president impeached, they'd like to see him removed from office. So, I think that the House Republicans are kind of incapable at this point of mounting a true defense as this rolls forward. So they are just going to sort of throw as many kind of peripheral things at it as they can, including asking Marie Yovanovitch things like, you know, why is your nickname Masha? You know, just really bizarre sorts of things.
Just sort of throwing implications out there without seeking truth, even if it's truth that might benefit the administration.
Exactly.
You know, I think back to the whistleblower. It does seem as though in some ways I'm interested in where he or she stood in government. At the same time, you know, with the protections Jackie was talking about earlier, there are reasons for that. And there have been so much many other people coming forward and testifying. It seems as though it's almost like an issue for early October rather than for mid-November. I want to take a call now from Alburnett, Iowa. I hope I've rendered that right. Dave, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling in. What's your thinking about what you're seeing play out in front of you?
Hi, David. A huge fan of the show.
Lovely.
Daily listener. And yeah, right out here in the middle of the cornfields of Iowa, Alburnett, you did just fine with that. So
fantastic.
My feelings on this impeachment are twofold. I think, A, they should wrap it up. I mean, really kind of move it along. I think they're going at a pretty good pace, but I think the guy's going to get acquitted in the Senate, and we're going to have to beat him in the ballot box in 2020. That's my first point.
My second
you're a point
Democrat.
Is Congress. I'm a Mayor Pete Democrat. That's
gotcha.
Correct.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
I also think that the Congress needs to wrap this up because they still seem to they don't seem to be able to do anything that's really needed in my neck of the woods out here in rural Iowa, which is the UMCA, trade, prescription drugs, things that they simply can't get done. I mean, the USMCA, which we need badly, has been sitting in the speaker's desk for a better part of a year. The EPA regulations on renewable fuel standards and giving all the waivers for ethanol need to be dealt with, and it doesn't seem like they can do anything. And so on that point, I'm getting weary.
When you say the UNCA, can you share with listeners when you say UNCA, what are you referring to?
The United States Mexican Canada Trade Agreement.
Oh, I'm sorry. So of course, it's the, sort of the new NAFTA, as it were. No. Don't apologize. Yeah. We're happy to have that. So this, Dave, I appreciate your call and I appreciate your insight. Karen Tumulty, you know, we're going to be getting to the election questions after the next break. But at the same time, you know, the Congress is wrapped up in this, right? There's not a lot of mental space to do split screens, as they talked about during the Clinton years, to get other stuff done.
Speaker Pelosi makes a public
– Karen, go ahead.
Well, and it's interesting that every time – every time you hear Speaker Pelosi these days, she will begin her presentation by talking about all the things that the House has passed that are stalled in the Senate, and also the things like doing something about prescription drugs, which they would really like to make some progress on. So despite Senator Kennedy's aspersions about her intelligence, I think Speaker Pelosi very much realizes that this election is also going to have to be won on the issues.
Jackie Kucinich, a couple other developments this week. I want to get to some of them. First off, I guess I want to acknowledge there was this development where it turned out that the Attorney General Bill Barr had been asked by the president, according to New York Times, Washington Post, other outlets, had asked by the president to hold a public press conference essentially exonerating him from the quid pro quo, which he seems to kind of have done, at least in terms of any campaign finance violations on paper. But he didn't want to hold a press conference doing it publicly. What does this say about the president's desires in this direction? And what does it say about the relationship the president has with his attorney general at the moment?
Well, it certainly doesn't seem like something that would be out of character. I mean, let's not forget what Bill Barr did during when the Mueller report first came out. He came out with this very short statement that essentially mischaracterized what the actual full report said and took the narrative in a completely different direction with the American public. So he's played defense, I guess, for the president in the past. Now, on this Ukraine situation, the Justice Department broadly has tried to sort of distance himself from this. Now, they did issue a statement initially saying that part of this was reviewed by justice and they decided that nothing was wrong. I'm paraphrasing, of course. But in other ways, when Mick Mulvaney had that press conference a few weeks ago and mentioned DOJ, DOJ said, no, we don't have anything to do with this. So you are seeing on this particular issue, there seems to be a step back. Now, the president is denying this. The president doesn't tell the truth a lot of the time. So on issues like this, and it's usually borne out by reporting later on and in this reporting now. So we have to take that for what it is. But and it doesn't seem to have damaged their relationship yet. But certainly the fact that justice does seem to be not as inclined is interesting, to say the least.
There seem to be other frustrations for the president. There's a book out by this anonymous White House aide, which doesn't have a lot of specifics, but sort of talks atmospherically about what life was like inside the White House, sort of indicating the president is juvenile, unpredictable, and destructive. The president's former political advisor, Roger Stone, is in court, and although it's not clear exactly what import to attach to it, prosecutors have indicated the president's interactions with Roger Stone were far more intense and frequent than realized in the period in which Stone was trying to do things involving the leaks of Democratic emails obtained by Russians and whisked over to WikiLeaks during that 2016 period. And then there's Trump's legal concerns with a charity. I want to, before talking a bit about that, Jack Beatty, there's this speech given by U.S. District Judge Paul Friedman in which he claimed that the president's rhetoric violates all recognized democratic norms. He gave this during a lecture in Washington on Wednesday. He said, "We're in uncharted territory. We're witnessing a chief executive who criticizes virtually every judicial decision that doesn't go his way and denigrates judges who rule against him, sometimes in very personal terms. He seems to view the courts and the justice system as obstacles to be attacked and undermined, not as a co-equal branch to be respected, even when he disagrees with its decisions." And Jack, this comes in the same week that as it turns out, a state judge ruled that the president had to give $2 million to various charities and shut down his foundation, acknowledge essentially wrongdoing and diverting charity funds for his own uses, and basically to say you're not going to create a new charity unless it's under official watch in so doing. What does it say to you, Jack, about the moment that we're in where the judiciary is ruling on the president in a variety of different forums at a time at which he's attacking that institution itself, according to this federal judge?
Well, it's a good moment for the judiciary. They're stepping up. The separation of powers really requires that. And it'll be put to the test in the Supreme Court shortly with a couple of important decisions that the Roberts Court will have to make about the admissibility of various presidential submissions, his tax returns, whether they can be released to the New York prosecutor. So we're going to find out how the Supreme Court reacts. But you know this. This judgment on the charities, there's just one thing I just want to mention here. We all remember early in the 2016 campaign, the president refused to appear on Fox News. It was a Fox News debate because one of the moderators had asked him a question that embarrassed him, and he didn't want to have to do that again. And he said, "I'm going to hold a rally instead in Iowa, and I'm going to raise money for vets." He held a rally. He said, "I raised $6 million for vets, and it's going to go to the vets." And by the way, we got a list of the vets groups that are going to get it. You can get it after the rally, and so on. And now it comes out that he didn't raise $6 million; he raised $2.8 million, and instead of going to the vets, that went to his campaign. That's about as low a deal. This is a rich man, right? And he's making a big deal out of doing this for the vets, and he did it for his pocket, for his campaign.
Let's give Karen's colleague David Farenthold a lot of credit for bird-dogging that and figuring out where the money went and where the money did not go. Up next, we're going to be taking a look at this week's election results from Virginia and Kentucky, and we'll be checking in with the 2020 presidential race, as well as the implications for races around the country. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. In other news this week, at least 9 members of an American Mormon family were shot and killed in northern Mexico on Monday. Authorities suspect the women and children were victims of a territorial dispute between rival drug cartels. Over 400 people serving low-level drug and nonviolent offenses were walked free from Oklahoma State prisons on Monday. Lawmakers are calling it the largest single-day commutation in U.S. history. Also, French President Emmanuel Macron says the NATO alliance is suffering from brain death, accusing Trump of undermining it by going his own way on Syria, Turkey, and the Kurds. You can join our conversation. For listeners in Virginia or Kentucky, did you cast a vote in this week's big state races? What's your take on the results? What are you thinking about how the 2020 race stands? Follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking this week with Karen Tumulty. She's national political columnist for The Washington Post, Jackie Kucinich, Washington bureau chief for The Daily Beast, and On Point's own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Karen, let's start with you and your backyard. Let's talk about Virginia. That's a state that had been considered a bellwether state. On Tuesday night, the Democratic governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam, declared victory for his party there.
I have one question for you. Do you all like the color blue? Yeah! I said, do you like the color blue? Because I'm here to officially declare today, November the 5th, 2019, that Virginia is officially blue. Congratulations.
Karen Tumulty, is he right? What does that say?
It is extraordinary how quickly, in at least in political years, Virginia has gone from being a very red state to a very blue state, you know, with only a brief pause as a true bellwether swing state. It started at the top of the ticket. Virginia went from between LBJ and Barack Obama. It did not vote for a single Democrat for president. It voted Republican again and again and again. And it has not voted for a Republican since then. And we also then saw gradually over the next few years, the statewide offices all started also going Democratic. But with the flipping of the legislature, both houses, Tuesday night, it is just top to bottom a Democratic state. And there are a couple of things that I think are really interesting here. One is the degree to which this has been, you know, self-immolation on the part of the Republicans. As the state changes demographically, they have actually been going further and harder right. Whether it was the transvaginal ultrasound bill that they tried to pass a few years back on abortion, or, as recently as this year, after a mass shooting that saw a dozen people killed in Virginia, they adjourned a special session to deal with gun control after only 90 minutes. They wouldn't even look at things like expanded background checks or red flag laws. So the tide is rising and the Republicans keep, swimming into it. And the second thing that I am really struck by in Virginia is the activism of women. You have seen a lot of these offices. For instance, last year in the state legislature, they flipped something like 15 House seats from Republican to Democrat. 11 of those were done by women candidates. The gender gap in Virginia is just enormous these days. So this is a political transformation, I think, that has been very much led by women in Virginia.
Jack Beatty, I want to turn attention a little bit to another commonwealth, right? There's Commonwealth of Virginia, now the Commonwealth of Kentucky, and a couple of elements of that. First, let's talk a little bit about the actual result. You had the current governor, Matt Bevin. He's epically unpopular, conservative. We can talk a little bit about why he's unpopular. But he seems to have lost by only 5,000 votes, and he has called for an official re-canvass of the election result of the Kentucky governor's race. At a press conference Wednesday, he pointed to what he claimed were a number of significant irregularities.
We know there have been thousands of absentee ballots that were illegally counted. That is known, and this, again, is something that's being looked into. We know that there are reports of people having been turned away, incorrectly turned away from various voting booths around the state. Again, things that need to be corroborated and looked into.
And Jack Beatty, in looking at the Louisville Courier Journal and other outlets around the state, even some of his own Republicans in state government are saying, dude, you got to provide some evidence on this because you can't just go around claiming these things. What do you make of the governor's stance in response to this very razor-thin margin that has surfaced in the vote?
Well, it's a portent, isn't it, of what could happen in 2020. Recall that Donald Trump wouldn't accept his victory. Remember that? He kept saying, oh, I would have won if it weren't for these 3 million, whoever it was, votes in California that no one has ever discovered were somehow wrongly cast for Hillary Clinton. So he wouldn't accept his victory. And the question, I think, that hangs over American politics in the next year, and with Governor Bevin, a sort of, poor man's Trump, indicates is, will he accept his defeat? Should he be defeated? I think that's the real significance of what we're seeing here. And I'm glad, actually, to see these Republican lawmakers, I'm reading in a Kentucky paper here, basically saying, Governor, put up or shut up. Show us this evidence of fraud or whatever it is, or accept the results. Richard Hassan, the election expert at Berkeley, has written a piece basically showing how Bevin could steal the election because of peculiarities in the Kentucky law that allows the legislature to effectively begin to pick the governor under certain circumstances. It hasn't been used in 100 years. But I'm glad to see in this morning's paper that that looks like a remote possibility.
I'm going to declare a point of personal privilege. I think Professor Hassan is from my parents' university, UC Irvine. So I'm going to give a shout out to the mighty Anteaters there. I want to point out also that the governor has asked for a re-canvass, which means it would, I think, tally the individual counties. That's a little bit shy of what would be a full recount of each voter's ballot, the sort of nightmare of 2000, but sometimes necessary in very close races. I want to talk a little bit more about this just with this clip at a rally for Kentucky Governors Matt Bevin's re-election campaign in Lexington on Monday. President Trump placed himself at the center of what proved to be that very tight race.
If you lose, it sends a really bad message. It just sends a bad, and they will build it up. Here's the story. If you win, they're going to make it like ho-hum. And if you lose, they're going to say Trump suffered the greatest defeat in the history of the world. This was the greatest. You can't let that happen to me.
All right, we're going to take a couple of calls now. First, Sebastian is calling from Richmond, Virginia. Go ahead, Sebastian.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to talk about how impeachment really didn't seem like an issue that was relevant to, I guess, more swing voters and independent voters in Virginia and Kentucky. I know the Kentucky governor focused more on health care, and in Virginia it was very much largely focused on gun reform. And I was curious whether you think that this will continue on as a strategy for Democrats, particularly into 2020 Senate and House races.
I think that's a great question to throw to part of my panel. Thank you, Sebastian, for that call. Jackie Kucinich, how big a deal is impeachment? How big a national thing? Was President Trump right? Should we look at Kentucky through that prism? Mississippi's governor-elect Tate Reeves is a Republican. He might have won from a slightly smaller or somewhat smaller margin than Republicans win in Mississippi, but he won handily. How much are these federal national races and how much are they kind of specific to the issues in front of the voters right there?
Well, I think if you ask President Trump now, he wouldn't want to view Matt Bevin through the impeachment prism because Matt Bevin's attempt to nationalize that race and to make impeachment an issue didn't really work out well for him. And I think most smart people would say that's because Matt Bevin was so unpopular that the president couldn't haul him out of the hole. I was in Ohio a few weeks ago and talking to Democrats and Republicans, and impeachment really wasn't coming up yet. Now, once this becomes, the main event in Congress, and once this is something that, it's the only thing coming out of Washington, I would imagine you have more people engaged. But, on the ground, I was hearing a lot more, frankly, about climate change and healthcare, which I know we've probably heard from a lot of folks who've been out in the country, than impeachment at this point. All that said, I think for some, and you're hearing this from some of these Democrats that are in districts that Trump won in 2016. They're concerned. And as much about the impeachment taking over, as much as about the last caller, what he was saying about some of the other issues that they need to move through Congress to have a something to run on, something like the trade agreement, something like prescription drug reform. That is, there is concern that impeachment would overtake something like that, where these folks could show that they didn't go to Washington just to run up against President Trump.
Looking further south, let's go to Alabama for a moment, Jackie Kucinich, and talk about Jeff Sessions, the once the former Alabama senator, the possibly future one. He's entering a crowded field. Doug Jones, a Democrat, won against the controversial former state chief justice down there, Roy Moore. Controversial because he was accused of basically sexually assaulting underage girls during that last race that Moore ran. And yet, Sessions comes back from Washington, from the Justice Department, where he had been attorney general, kind of a humbled figure, it seems to me. What does he look like as a candidate for next year?
I don't know Shakespearean or what it would be in a literary comparison, but Jeff Sessions had stayed in that seat and not become the attorney general. He probably would have been there for as long as he could possibly want it. And now he has to fight for it. He was the first I believe he was the first senator to endorse President Trump or then candidate Trump, and was with him throughout the entire campaign. But his, original sin in Trump's perspective of recusing himself from the Russia investigation just shattered any trust and, you know, in that the president had in him and ruined that relationship. And the president still hasn't let that go. This morning, he was asked whether he would campaign against Jeff Sessions. And he said, I won't, but we'll see how it goes. And then he said something to the effect of, there's some stiff competition. So while Sessions has a war chest, he has universal, I'm sure, name recognition in the state. He's finding himself, this could be a battle if Trump decides that maybe he does want to have someone else in there and doesn't want Jeff Sessions back in Washington.
Which is fascinating given how tightly, as we heard at the top of the hour, Sessions is wrapping himself around the Trump agenda as he tries to present himself to voters. This obviously a seat seen as probably one of the most vulnerable ones for Democrats, even as they hope to possibly regain the Senate. Speaking of Russia.
He's one step behind holding a boombox outside of the White House. I'll say anything.
Say Alabama, I guess.
Say Alabama. Say y'all.
Say y'all. Meanwhile, speaking of Russia, Trump tells reporters this morning he's considering visiting Russia in May. Putin invited him to attend and observe the May Day parade. It's worth noting that the May Day parade inspired Trump's musings to Defense Secretary Jim Mattis at the time and others that he wanted a similar military-style parade down Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. So far, that has not materialized. In the presidential race, looking ahead to 2020, Karen Tumulty, Beto O'Rourke has exited the scene. And Michael Bloomberg, the former New York mayor, the media magnate, the billionaire whose fortune wildly dwarfs that of the president, is noodling around with the idea of entering the presidential race. He's filing papers in Alabama to register for that state's Democratic primary because the deadline is rushing toward him. And if he's going to do it, he's going to have to be submitted there. Karen, in some ways, what problem is Mike Bloomberg solving that he just thinks in this late moment he wants to enter this crowded field?
Well, I know what he thinks he's solving. He had originally said that he would not run if Joe Biden ran because he thought that Joe Biden would be a formidable candidate and would take the kind of centrist sort of tack that Michael Bloomberg would prefer. But I think it's what he is saying and what you're hearing from a lot of Democrats is they are really getting scared by Joe Biden's weak performance as a candidate. And there is a great fear that the party's next nominee is going to be Elizabeth Warren. And so I think Bloomberg's thought, and this is a guy who's had this idea that he wants to run for president and never really gotten into it. He's been thinking about it for years, but he's essentially, you know, trying to throw his body on the tracks to stop that train.
But it's fascinating because at least if you look at Democratic voters, just to push back on that a little bit, you know, polls taken by reliable pollsters for HuffPost, for The Economist, for Gallup, you know, found that Democratic primary voters anyway are highly satisfied. They think they have two or more candidates who could defeat Trump. That's 71% of Democratic-leaning voters. 53% of Democratic or Democratic-leaning voters thought they were three or more candidates who could beat him. And you've got people like Senator Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, Joe Biden. You know, there's some people on the Democratic center, right? So it's surprising. I mean, he's obviously a guy with a lot of money and great name recognition, but it's interesting to me that he thinks – you know, is this a conversation that's happening on Wall Street and among media elites, or is this actually a conversation happening when you go to Iowa?
Well, it's interesting too because at the Post this week we had a poll come out that showed that we tested the top five names in the field in a hypothetical head to head against Donald Trump, and they all beat him handily. So but you do hear this concern that as the primary moves forward and perhaps voters start looking a little more carefully at some of these candidates' positions on the issues, probably starting with Medicare for All, that maybe, you know, these are candidates who couldn't beat Trump. I don't know if that's the case.
That'll be the last word hearing from the president this morning. He said that there's no one he'd rather run against than little Michael. He doesn't have the magic. The words we've been hearing from Karen Tumulty, national political columnist for The Washington Post. Thanks so much, Karen, for joining us.
Great to be here.
And thanks to Jackie Kucinich, Washington bureau chief for The Daily Beast. We appreciate your being here as well.
Thank you so much.
And our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. Have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you, David.
You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitters and Facebooks at On Point Radio. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik. You've been listening to On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.